live in an era which likes to make its education dramatic. So it is perhaps fitting that this morning, when our lecture is concerned with the family, that we received a dramatic lesson in what makes family living such a delight. The father or mother announce a decision, and the family blithely carries on in its own path as if the decision was never announced. America has been taking inventory. We are entering a new decade, and we want to know where we stand. Many important and learned articles have been written on the state of our foreign policy, of our science and of our technology, our standard of living and our rate of production, our civil liberties and our freedoms. But strangely, there has been almost nothing written, silence, concerning that aspect of daily life which affects each and every one of us the most intimately. The question as to the vitality and the stability of our families. Perhaps it is so because all is well with our families. Family life is strong and healthy, and no one need address his mind and his talents to a discussion of the American family. But when Dr. Joseph Reed, the head of the Child Welfare League of America, asked himself recently in a rhetorical vein the very simple question, is all well with the American family? His answer was equally simple and direct and monosyllabic, no. What was his concern for the American family? Basically this, that the American family has lost the dimension of permanence, that the broken home has become as much a part of the American landscape as a split-level house, that the American family fairy tale no longer ends and they lived happily ever after, but ends rather and they lived happily for a short time thereafter. Last year alone in the United States, 380,000 couples were divorced. Last year alone in these United States, 22,000 marriages were annulled. Last year alone in these United States, 210,000 desertions were reported to the authorities. And last year alone in our own country, 3,100,000 men and women were living separate from, apart from their husbands or their wives. The American family has lost its stability. This is our concern. The American seems to have transposed the marriage vow. Do you promise to love, honor, and cherish until death do you part, so that it reads to love, honor, and to cherish until life do you part. And there is cause for this concern, because the broken home, the disintegrating, dismembered family, affects the welfare and well-being of all of us, and not simply the happiness and the welfare of those most intimately involved. It was Dr. Carl Zimmerman of the Department of Social Relations of Harvard University who coined the very happy phrase that the family is the moving figure of history. His allusion is, of course, to Daniel in our Bible, who saw written on the wall of the king's palace through the agency of a moving finger the augury, the prophecy of the future. The family makes the future. A strong family contributes to a stable society. A weak, disintegrating family saps the vigor of the society. A strong family teaches by example citizenship and character. It breeds confidence. The broken home produces the rootless, lonely, unhappy human being. The human being who will never find fulfillment for his talents, will never be able to live up to his promise of creativity, who in his aloneness, in his frustration, in his guilt is ready grist for the demagogue's mill. the dismemberment of our homes, the quicksand upon which the foundations of so many of our homes seem to be built, augurs poorly for our future, because it poisons the wells of spiritual vigor from which a country and a nation draws ultimately its strength. And what is more, it scars the lives of hundreds upon thousands of innocent young people. A child thrives in love. A child withers, draws in upon himself, his personality becomes contorted when that love is withdrawn from him, when he feels insecure and unwanted. Last year, in the last years, 14 million American children have suffered the trauma of a broken home. They will bear the scars of this trauma throughout their lifetime. Some of the scars showed immediately in learning problems and problems of adjustment and antisocial behavior. Some will show only later, when they are unwilling to accept, unable to accept adult love, because unconsciously they fear that ultimately, in time, that love will be withdrawn from them. Some of them will live bitter, vindictive lives, punishing all about them for their childhood hurt. Some will draw in upon themselves, shelter themselves under a shell, and be unable to relate to their society. In some way, most of these young people will bear throughout their lives the agony of their childhood hurt. They will suffer and we will suffer, because in the long run, their anger, their frustration will spill out, involve, poison the lives of those about them. Have we Jews, as a religious community, reason to be concerned with the disintegration of the American home, or is it completely a non-Jewish problem? The Jewish home has in history had a legendarily high rate of stability and health. Perhaps we have avoided in America any semblance of joining in the rush to the divorce court. Unfortunately, there is no mystique of faith which permits us to assume that the Jewish family too will not suffer the disintegration which is so widespread on the American scene. Indeed, year by year, perceptibly, the rate of divorce in the Jewish community is rising higher and higher and approximating closer and closer to the rate of divorce in the community about us. Statistics are hard to come by. But broadly, the picture is this. One marriage in three nationally ends in divorce. One marriage in five within our religious community is today ending in divorce. Many of these involve intermarriages. But when all is said and done, for better and for worse, the Jewish community is accepting the manners and the mores of the community about us. And there is a tragedy in this. A tragedy that as a religious community, we have not been able to accept the blessings and hold ourselves aloof from the feelings of the American community. How much better would it have been if our spiritual walls had been high, if we had been able to maintain the higher levels of family stability, the higher and nobler concepts of family living which come from our tradition, hoping in time that these would transpose themselves, transfer themselves by example to the community about us. But apparently this is not to be the case. Apparently in our patterns and habits of life, we as Jews are going to approximate, are determined to approximate the manners and morals and mores of those with whom we live. The disintegrating American home is then a cause of concern to all of us. Why has the home so traditionally, so historically, the bulwark any society begun in modern American life to disintegrate and be dismembered? In part, in largest part, The answer lies in the sweeping economic and political and technological revolution, the Industrial Revolution, which has swept over the world in the last century and a half or two centuries. The factory has replaced the farm as the basic unit of production. The city has replaced the hamlet as the basic elemental unit of domicile. The home is no longer the center of production, of education, of recreation, of identity. But these functions have been taken over by organizations outside of the home. And the home is today a motel, a hamburger haven, and a darkened TV theater. Writing of the changes which have overtaken the American home, Dr. Reed has this to say. There are 43 million American families, and they vary with all the richness that human differences and opportunities in a democracy permit. But all have been and still are subject in some measure to the radical changes that have taken place in all aspects of American life in the past 100 years. Some families have had 3, 4, or 5 generations to assimilate and adjust to that change. Others, like the Puerto Ricans, have felt its full force in the few hours it takes to fly from San Juan to New York, or like the Southern Negroes, in the time it takes a bus to travel from the Mississippi Delta to Chicago. Today's family is a very different family. The couple married out of romantic love. Their marriage was not arranged, as it would have been, by their parents. This couple see their own parents perhaps once a year, and the rest of the relatives, for the most part, exist only as an annual Christmas card list. They expect to move at least 2 or 3 times while their children are growing up, not infrequently to other states or even across the country. Our cultural pattern is such that it is almost taken for granted that the family will move if a better opportunity is found elsewhere. A job with increased status, a better climate, or better educational opportunities for the children. Family friends must be newly made, perhaps every 2 or 3 years. The family today must establish its own status. Few know and fewer care what the grandfather had achieved or who the great-grandfather had been. No generation-established reputation follows the family. Its status is almost wholly determined by the husband's achievement in his occupation. He cannot gain status simply by being a good provider of the necessities of life. He is expected to advance, to be somebody, and to provide the necessary symbols of success: a car, a color TV set, a better neighborhood for his family to live in. What he does during most of his waking hours is almost unknown to his family. For in addition to working long hours to get ahead, he must often spend a good part of his day commuting. The more ambitiously he responds to the goals of his culture, the more apt he is to become detached from his family responsibilities. Even if the status of women had not changed, the husband could not realistically be, in the old sense, the head of his household. Recreation and education, including religious education, are provided by someone else. The children of the family are no longer an economic asset. The traditional roles of husband and wife are no longer distinct, and each family must find its own balance. The wife no longer has a clear-cut role. The demand for industrial workers has taken millions of mothers into industry. At the same time, her role as mother and housewife has been devalued. It is of low status. Often from her employment, she may earn as much or more than her husband. The mores of the community, its patterns of sexual conduct, its standards and values are not so clear or so socially enforced as they once were. In essence, the family is alone, isolated, separated from relatives or those to whom it would be natural to turn for counsel. It must in large part make its own choices, vote its own decisions, establish its own values. In short, the Industrial Revolution in America, Industrial Revolution throughout the world, has brought with it a familial dissolution and dismemberment. 50 years ago, one family in three in America lived in a rural or farming community. These families involved in the same house three or four generations. The home was the center of activity, the matrix around whom all the educational and recreational and social and religious activities of these individuals revolved. Today, less than one family in 10 lives in such a community. The others have had to congregate, to congest themselves into center cities, to live largely anonymous lives, to live largely outside of their homes. Their jobs now take them outside of their homes. Their production takes them outside of their homes. Their religion takes them outside of their homes. Their education takes them outside of their homes. Their recreation takes them outside of their homes. And the homes have been left an empty shell. The web of family relationships has, in short, been drawn taut and thin. And lacking richness and lacking depth, these webs have often, under stress and strain, broken and been torn and ruptured and torn asunder. Now, some have tried to solve this problem of the modern American home by, in essence, turning back the clock of history. They have said, and this is the reason for our suburbias and our exurbias, they have said, in short, that the modern society requires that we congregate for our businesses, that we work in a central factory or in a central office building. But the industrial society does not require that we live near where we work. It is still possible to have our homes in the countryside, surrounded by trees, away from the congestion of the city streets and the cacophony of city noises. And some families have been able to find in suburban living a slower, less hectic pace of life, a greater degree of identity, rootedness, values which lend support and strength to the family. But the rate of divorce, my friends, in our suburbs is as high as it is in our cities. Of themselves, the suburbs have not staunched the flood of divorce. Why is this so? It is so in part because the husband in the suburb is away from his family even more than he would be in the city itself. For he must add to his time at work, commuting time. And this is often great. Often all that a husband during the work week sees of his family is a hasty evening snack, a shave as the family prepares to go out for some social occasion, and then a look into his children's bedrooms as he tiptoes and puts them to bed. The husband is less and less with the family. The wife is less and less with the family. For in the suburbs, she not only assumes the responsibilities of her home, but she assumes the responsibilities of the community. It is she who makes the suburban community work, its organizations interrelate. She is, as we would say in our tradition, the suburban macher. And so she spends less and less time in the home. And the child spends less and less time in the home. It takes him a while to get to school. He's no longer around the corner. When his recreation is to take place, it must be planned. Transportation is involved. It is centered in some activity or some institution. So in and of itself, the suburb has not solved the problem of the attenuated family living of modern society. Indeed, many who sought to find the bucolic atmosphere of suburban living have seen it only through the alcoholic haze which surrounds it. And in that haze, many have forgotten themselves, forgotten their vows, and forgotten their children. Others have tried to solve the status of the modern family by making available to the family information, clinics, family service associations, agencies where they could go to seek help. Many fine schools have adopted family life courses, where high school age youngsters are made aware of some of the necessary information for any householder, for any partner in a marriage, where they are taught something of personality adjustment, and where basic information is made available to them. All around our big cities, marriage clinics have developed. Indeed, America has pioneered in the professional development of the marriage counselor. But unfortunately, less than 20% of all the students in American schools today receive any family life training. Less than 0.1% of all those marriages which are tottering and teetering ever seek the professional help available to them. And were all such marriages to seek that help, we would not begin to have the professionals to provide it. Less than 1% of all adult Americans in their whole lifetimes, my friends, ever attend a single course, not to speak of a single lecture, on marriage and its responsibilities. You can provide help, but you cannot enforce. You cannot force people to abide and to accept. And until there is a desire, a widespread desire on the parts of the millions of Americans who make up our marriage couples to take advantage of these resources, to shore up the shaky foundations of their homes, a few marriages will be saved. The larger problem will remain unsolved. Others have sought to meet the problem of the American home through legal remedy. Efforts have been made in our several states to equalize the rules and regulations surrounding divorce. Attempts have been made to close the notorious divorce mills, where for a few dollars and a few moments a whole family can be immediately disintegrated. The legal profession has taken upon itself the responsibility and has largely discharged the responsibility to see to it that when a couple comes to them seeking help in a divorce proceeding, the first piece of business is not the filing of affidavits, but an attempt at reconciliation, at the rehabilitation of the home. And in our courts, domestic relations courts and other reconciliation activities have been established in many communities, which have made the courts an agency aimed at the rebuilding of the home rather than the sheer processing of a legal formula. But this too has not staunched the flood of divorce. This too has not prevented, year in and year out, the number of American families which are being disoriented and dismembered from growing tragically. So some have said, but since America has the highest rate of divorce of any nation of our world, and since divorce is easiest to come by in America of any major nation in our world, the problem and its solution lies in the divorce proceeding itself. Let us make divorce so difficult, they say, that it is well nigh impossible to come by. Let us limit the causes, the grounds for divorce to infidelity and nothing more. They argue that this was the intention of Jesus when he said, "Whom God has joined, let no man sunder." They argue that we ought to return to older, more moral, stabler, more religious ways, medieval days in which divorce was within the Catholic world well nigh an impossibility. But unfortunately, we remember prohibition. And we know that you cannot force millions of people to live as they will not live. That were we to close the doors to divorce, all we would succeed in doing would be to force an open flaunting of a notorious flaunting of the marriage vows. And at least today, marriage, if it is not permanent, at least retains some of its sanctity. Divorce is a symptom. It is the product of a broken family. It does not create the broken family. The ease with which divorce is gained has nothing to do with the rate of divorce. Would you see proof of that? You have only to turn to our Jewish tradition. For strangely, within our Jewish faith, divorce was easier to come by than it is even in America today. No one had to prove to a court that there were substantial grounds for divorce. It was sufficient that a young couple would come and say, "We can no longer live together. We have no longer anything in common. We find that our destinies are separate. We desire to be separated." And the divorce was granted. For Israel knew that it is poetically a beautiful image to say that all marriages are made in heaven. But that realistically, olden days, parents often badly mismatched their children, and in modern times, love is often blind. And that it is far better for a young couple who are impossibly bound together to separate than it is to chain them to a life of anguish and unhappiness and anger. And what is to be gained by forcing such a young couple to burlesque infidelity as they must in some American states? That is simply a debasing and a degrading procedure. Jewish divorce was easy to come by, but it was rarely attempted, rarely desired. Why so? Why was the Jewish home so stable? The answer, I think, is a simple one. The answer lies in the cultural milieu in which the home was built. In matters of love and marriage, the Jewish world was an adult world, a world which knew full well that you cannot separate romantic love and the responsibilities of marriage, that these are not disparate entities, but the obverse and the reverse of a single coin. We in America, my friends, live in, I'm afraid, as it faces love, we live in an adolescent world. Our world glorifies passion. The Jewish world knew passion, but it knew also patience. And it knew that these must be wedded together, passion and patience. In our modern world, marriage is the climax of desire. In the Jewish world, marriage was the commencement of devotion. We in America say, "I will betroth thee." The Jew said, "I will betroth thee forever." He took the long view, not the short view. He spoke of not only romance, but responsibility. And it is understandable, perhaps, that we have emphasized romance. We have revolted against medieval ways in which marriages were planned for the young people. But is it not equally important to tell our young people that beyond falling in love, they must rise in love, they must build a family, they must plan for the future? And this we have culturally neglected to do. But you say, "I told this to my son. I told that to my daughter." And you yourself, Rabbi, when you married them, told them that their love must not only be surging and compelling, but a love which knows how to share, a love which knows how to sustain, a love which knows how to sacrifice. And we did, you and I. And fortunately, many of our young people listened. But what of those whose parents were not so wise? What of those who were married not before a religious leader, but before some backcountry justice of the peace? What did their culture say to them? What did their literature say to them? That it is lust, not love, which is essential. That love is erotic. Live for the moment. The bliss of the hour is the essential thing, not the blessing of a lifetime of companionship and happy love. What does their entertainment tell our young people? Our entertainment. It pictures to them the tender trap of love. It pictures for them all the enticements of romance. But it does ever picture for them the the routine, daily, loving living of husband and wife together through the years, through the anniversaries. No, it does not. The love goddess and her suitor clasp together in a lingering embrace, and that is the end of our entertainment. But life begins where entertainment ends. This our younger generation does not always recognize or know. And what of our humor? With what voices does it speak to this generation? Our humor about our intimacies, the intimate moments of our lives, is coarse, is it not? It is coarse, it is sexual, and it is public. And yet these intimacies, these intimate moments, are the foundation, the bedrock of any happy marriage. And ought they not to be sensitive moments, delicate moments, and private, intensely private moments? All in our society, my friends, speaks to our young people and to us of pleasure for pleasure's sake. It fails to remind us that beyond pleasure there is responsibility. Beyond the sensual, there is a sacrificial. You can see it in the terms which we use for marriage. The word marriage itself comes from the Latin, from a word maritare, which means simply to be together, to live together. The Hebrew word for marriage is kiddushin. It comes from the root kadosh, to be holy. It says that beyond the sensual, there must be the sacred. That beyond physical attraction, there must be spiritual attraction. That beyond mating, there must be union. In our tradition, marriage is a covenant, a holy contract entered into for a lifetime. It is a pledge of shared destiny, not the permission for an hour of ecstasy. I think it was Heine who once jestingly toasted, "Here's to matrimony, the high seas for which no one has ever invented a compass." Now, the problems of married life are many, and they are varied, and they shade and are variegated according to the number of couples that exist. No one can give you a sure answer through all of your problems. Patience, will, resolution, understanding, wisdom, love, devotion, these are the answers. But I firmly believe this, and I put it to you this morning, that if we can raise our children in a more adult culture, if we can accept this adult culture for ourselves, if we can accept marriage as a responsibility beyond romance, if we can strip lust from love, desire from devotion, and put them back into a better balance, we will have gone a long way, you and I, towards establishing more stable families for ourselves and for our children and for our children's children. This, then, is the obligation which I would place before you this morning. To be adult in your expectations of marriage. It begins with love. In that, our generation is entirely correct. But it must be a mature love. A sacrificing, not a devouring love. An enduring love. Not a love simply for the immediate physical pleasure. A kiddushin, a sanctification, not merely a marriage. Amen.